This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Early voting in Indiana starts today for the November election. We're diving into the race for governor this week by listening to extended interviews with the three gubernatorial candidates, all conducted by Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Yesterday, we heard from incumbent Republican Governor Eric Holcomb, and today we'll hear from Democrat Woody Myers and Libertarian Donald Rainwater. What you'll hear from each interview is unedited, but we did have to cut them down to fit into our show and to give each candidate equal time. And since today's show was pre-taped, we can't take your questions and comments live, but we always love to hear what you think. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Let us know what you'd like us to cover leading up to the election. First up today, an interview with Democratic candidate Woody Myers.
Dr. Myers, thank you for joining me today. There's a few things I want to get to, but I want to start with this. You are a medical doctor and a former state health commissioner. You were the first black man to run for governor in the state of Indiana on a major party ticket in a year when a global pandemic and protests over racial injustice and police violence have dominated the headlines.
Right.
Why then haven't you gained more traction in this race?
Well, it depends on how you define traction. I believe that in each of the settings we've been in, especially since Labor Day, there's been a great deal of energy. There's been a great deal of enthusiasm. But you've got to remember as well that there are a lot of people who still today are concerned about aggregating, especially with strangers, even with masks. We've proven that masks are very helpful, but that masks don't completely prevent the virus from moving around. So I think that there are still some folks who would rather campaign and root for you at home or online as opposed to in person. And then with respect to other concerns, you know, it's really difficult to ask someone for funds for a campaign during a time when the economy is really in a recession, where a lot of folks are who never expected to be in a food line are actually in a food line. Where there's so much uncertainty, and that's been a big challenge for me, because I feel as if you have extra funds to give, then we would certainly appreciate them. But I'm not one of these guys that pushes really hard, and probably that makes me a less impressive financial candidate than some other people. And I just do what's right in my heart, and I ask for help from those that I think can provide it, but I don't force the issue. And I feel very good about that. And we'll get whatever funds that we get. We'll do whatever we can to use them properly to get our messages out. But I'm going to keep running. And I think that given the approach that we're taking, especially with the use of social media, we're attracting a lot of folks that few expected us to have at this point. And we've got now 6 or so weeks to go, and we're going to use every one of them.
So let's talk about those issues that have dominated the headlines so much this year, the first, of course, being COVID-19. What would you have done differently if you were running the state than what has been done so far here in Indiana?
Oh, so much. I wouldn't have followed Mike Pence's lead, for one thing, or Donald Trump's lead. And now we know that both of them have lied to the country repeatedly. There's the tapes to prove it. I know that we should have done our testing program far earlier, far more aggressively. Throughout the state of Indiana, although now here we are 6 months in, we're starting to get an adequate number of testing sites. We could have done so much earlier. We could have put them in the places where people are that truly need them. It was only a few weeks ago that Gary started to get the sites that it needed. I would have made sure that we had PPE. A number of governors were very aggressive in bringing PPE supplies together for the folks in their states. And they were far more successful than we were. Now we see that in our nursing homes, for instance, the cost of a dollar's worth of PPE 6 months ago was $6 to $10 now. And that has been because we did not aggregate our purchasing power. We did not have an inventory in place. That's something I would absolutely have done differently. I think that we could have inspired people far earlier on to use the social distancing and the masks that we know are the right way to go with respect to how to protect ourselves and our loved ones until there's an effective vaccine. We moved the stages along too quickly. In addition to that, we don't even today have really a mask mandate in Indiana. We have a mask suggestion in Indiana. We had a mandate for like 2 days. And then my opponent took a thought from the discredited attorney general of our state, and instead of using the powers that are in the law in order to manage a public health emergency, he took a pass on that. And now we have folks that who, for whatever reason, are not wearing their masks, same as we had 5 years ago, folks not wearing their seatbelts, and same as we had 10 years ago, folks that decided they would light up a cigarette wherever they were. That behavior has to change in order to protect Hoosiers from themselves and from each other, and I certainly would have made that a priority. In addition, it's only been recently that we've given guidance to our schools as to what they should do. Our superintendents were lost, and we had one district right next to another district that was in person versus all the way at home. There was really no guidance from either the CDC or the state as to what to do. The superintendents were begging for it. They only recently got it. And it's just my view that what was absent from the beginning was true leadership. In order to manage something as complex as a pandemic, you need good advice and you need to take a good stand based on science and you need to lead. And that's what we didn't have.
I want to ask about the idea of testing more early on. This is not a problem that solely Indiana had. A lot of states struggled to get their testing to where it needed to be. Is that then the fault of state leadership, or were we all as a society simply unprepared for the level of resources we would need to confront this pandemic?
Yes and yes. Yes, it was the fault of state leadership, and yes, we could have been better prepared nationally for it. And no, we did not work effectively together, either state to state or state with the federal government. All of this could have been done better at all levels.
So the governor has been criticized, particularly recently, for how much money from the Federal CARES Act, the COVID relief dollars, are still unspent in Indiana.
Right.
But we know that the guidance on how we are allowed to legally use those dollars from the federal government has been very inconsistent, changing sometimes almost week to week, and even contradictory week to week. And we also know that we are hoping for more flexibility because we are going to face a huge hole in our budget at the end of this fiscal year. So is it prudent for the governor to at least wait on some of this money to see what more comes out of the federal government?
And how many people will die during that wait? And how many more people will get infected during that wait? The answer is no. You use the funds that you have now, and if the federal government is guilty of not providing complete and adequate instruction, so you ask later for forgiveness. While Indiana people are getting infected, while Hoosiers are dying from this, and now well over 3,300 have died, you use those funds effectively to stop the spread of the virus, to decrease the number of people that are spreading it, and to decrease the illness and the injury and the death and the misery to the families of those who are deceased right now.
With so many police agencies across the state who, even before the governor said, well, we're not really trying to enforce the mask order, a lot of police agencies said they didn't think it was constitutional, any sort of enforcement was constitutional, and they weren't going to participate. So if you had been governor and you had put an enforcement mechanism in this law, would that really have been any more effective?
Yes. The police agencies are entitled to an opinion, or individuals are, but they don't determine what is or is not constitutional. The mask mandates that have been in other states have been far more effective. Yes, you can challenge things in court, and that possibly could happen, but during a public health emergency, the law gives the governor a lot of flexibility in what needs to be done. And there are plenty of scientific opinions, scientific articles that say that masks are the best use of the technologies that are available today until there's an effective vaccine and resulting immunity.
We're in this for the long haul. We hope that there's an effective vaccine sometime next mm-hmm. year. It might even begin rolling out late this year, but certainly not widely available anytime soon. Are people, whether or not Indiana has done the right thing or not in your view, going forward now, if you become governor starting in January, how do you get people on board with this isn't over? Because at that point we'll have been 8-9 months, and there's that kind of fatigue that settles in mm-hmm. with having to do all of the things we're supposed to be doing. How do you confront that?
With energy and enthusiasm. That's how you confront it, and you confront it every single day, and you confront it by example. The answer is leadership. The answer is that you bring together the people who know that it's important for this to happen. You solicit their advice and their opinions. You create an action plan. You give everyone their role within that plan, and then you execute that plan. That's how you lead. That's how you get things done. And no, we don't want our police departments, our law enforcement officials, finding everyone there is that doesn't wear a mask every day and then putting them in jail. That's not the point. The point is to have both a carrot and for some people who needed a stick. And I know that the vast majority of people, once they know that there is a true mandate in place, will follow it.
I want to talk about the other issue that has dominated our conversation the last, our national conversation, our state conversation the last several months, which is racial injustice, police brutality and violence against people of color, particularly black women, men and women. We've seen some steps that Governor Holcomb announced in recent weeks, the hiring of a cabin officer, reviewing all of the training that goes on at the police academy here in Indiana. What did you think of his response? Is it a good first step?
Well, you asked me what do I think. What I think is that if that's truly in his heart, if that's truly what he believes, then he could have done it 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago, when he first took office. Or he could have encouraged his previous boss, Mike Pence, to do it when he was in office. Or they could have encouraged, in his role as a leader in his party, the previous governor, Mitch Daniels, to do it. Here it is now that, you know, Brandon, we've got now almost 16 years. Of leadership in the state house by a Republican governor. And here it is, 60, 70 days before an election, that this is now an important issue. And with respect to the decisions that were made in the announcement, you know, I will appoint a cabinet that for whom everyone in the cabinet, diversity and inclusion will be an issue. I'm not going to need a special officer to look over the work of everybody else and then report on how everybody else is doing. I'm going to hire people from the beginning who know how important diversity is, who know how important inclusion is, and have them make it a part of their everyday activity. And then as we discuss what's going on in those agencies, that will just be a normal part of how they interact with me as the governor. So I think it's, as I said at the time, much too little, much too late.
We'll be back with our guests after a quick break. We're listening to extended, unedited interviews with Governor Eric Holcomb's challengers in the race for Indiana governor today, Democrat Woody Myers and Libertarian Donald Rainwater. Let us know what you think and what else you want to hear leading up to the November election. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, and you can download our new app called All In Vox Pop, which lets you send us a voice message that we can play during our show. Just search for All In Vox Pop wherever you get apps. It's free and it's super easy to use. I'm Matt Pelzer, back in less than 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Today we're listening to extended interviews with the two men challenging Eric Holcomb in the race for Indiana governor, conducted by Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. If you want to hear the interview with Governor Eric Holcomb that aired yesterday, you can find it on our website or as a podcast. Just search for All In Indiana. Now back to the conversation with Democratic candidate Woody Myers.
Racial inequity is certainly not a government-only problem. It's a problem that exists throughout society and every facet of society. So what is, then, the role of government to move this conversation forward?
Well, first of all, government should set a good example. It should set a good example with respect to the people that we hire, whether they're temporarily abled people, whether they're people of color, irrespective of their gender orientation and or their own sexual orientation. There should be a wide group of people that are talented, that that represent our state extremely well, and that are in all the various leadership positions. And that those are not just, Brandon, the people that I appoint, but in addition, they're as leaders. There are people that I appoint in task forces, committees, and so on and so forth throughout the state. I'm told that the governor can make over 1,000 appointments during his or her term, and that will be the most thoughtful group of diverse people that this state has ever seen. In addition, you put it on the front burner as an issue, as an agenda item. You talk about it often. You point out ways in which our state has done well, but you also point out the ways in which our state needs to improve. And at any and every opportunity that I can as the state's next governor, that's what I will do. I'll praise successes, and I'll encourage folks that aren't moving as quickly as they should or could on this issue. And then With respect to training opportunities, both inside the government and outside, we'll make many more of those available. One of the key things that we've learned about racial injustice, as it's been studied far more intensely in the last decade than ever before, is this concept of implicit bias. And what that means is that there are so many people who don't think of themselves as being a racially insensitive person or a racist, who have implicit biases that are unconscious, they're not even aware of consciously. And you have to find ways to point that out so people become far more conscious of the fact, well, my gosh, that was a problem statement. I shouldn't have said it that way. I shouldn't have looked at it that way. And it's just amazing the number of people who go through that kind of an exercise and that kind of a training and find out things about themselves and others that they didn't realize. And that's why I think it's so important, especially for our law enforcement officers, to truly understand that issue. Because we can clearly see on the videos that have been taken that there have been many African-American people, many Latinx people that have been treated unfairly by those in law enforcement. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And that has to change. And I think that that's why racial injustice has to be a focus of all of our law enforcement agencies, from all the way at the top to the local police departments, and has to be a part of our correctional system officers and everyone who has the power over another person legally to suppress them and potentially to harm them.
There are folks who are calling, obviously, for defunding the police. Mm-hmm. And for many, that means moving funding away from traditional law enforcement models to models that focus on not necessarily just police, but more like mental health professionals, that sort of thing. What do you see as the role for Indiana and Indiana's governor in the police reform conversation specifically?
Well, first of all, we're not going to defund the police. What we are going to do is to encourage some reprogramming of the funds that are available. For instance, dash cam cameras, cameras on officers, that cameras that are used, not turned off on command. Those are the kinds of things that I think we have to do. I think that in addition to that, we have to ban those restrictive practices, such as chokeholds. That's not the only one, but that's one of them that's received a lot of attention lately. We don't want officers putting his or her knee on anyone's neck and when they're restrained. That person often hasn't even been arrested, let alone tried and convicted. And if that person were convicted, that would not be the punishment. There are much better ways to get control of an individual. And then in addition to that, so many of the people for whom there's been assistance requested have problems related to substance use disorder or have problems related to their own mental health. It's clear that a law enforcement officer typically does not have that kind of training as a mental health professional to know how to talk someone down or recognize the signs and symptoms of substance use disorder. And that's why so many departments today are including mental health professionals as they determine what the action steps are when they get a call. For instance, if you know that you're getting a call from 123 Main Street, and we know that there's someone at 123 Main Street on many prior occasions who has a mental health issue, then it's usually a good idea to involve mental health professionals at the time that call is responded to. Those are the kinds of techniques that people are utilizing in police departments all over the nation today that they're finding very effective. We've got to do much more of that in Indiana.
With any, and this goes to any candidate really, but there are obviously things that you want to do as governor that haven't been done before, and a lot of times those things cost money.
Mm-hmm.
And we are unfortunately going to be confronting at least one budget, maybe a couple, that isn't as robust as the last several have been, mm-hmm. for obvious reasons, mm-hmm. The economic challenges that COVID has wrought. How do you, as a candidate, how do you talk to people and say, I want to do this, this, and this, when the budget challenges aren't going to allow for a lot of that?
Well, that's where my 30-plus years of executive experience come into play. That's what I've been doing virtually my entire professional life. Any executive who's unable to go into a big budget like the Indiana state budget and find things that can be done more efficiently or find things that made sense 10 years ago but don't make sense today and find things that you can merge together in order to create a lower fixed cost. If you can't do that, then you have no business applying for and being elected to this job. And that's something that we'll do in conjunction with my agency heads, state budget director, state board of accounts, and others. we're going to make sure that this is a lean machine going forward, and that we are doing everything we can to shepherd the taxpayers' dollars far better than the current administration. For instance, the current administration allowed Indiana Virtual Schools near Daleville to waste over $70 million of the taxpayers' money. And when they found out about it, the finger pointing went all different kinds of directions. It wasn't a priority. It wasn't something that this administration decided that was important to do. What would a $70 million have done for Indianapolis Public Schools or Evansville Schools or Muncie Schools or Gary Community Schools? I think a lot. And there are other examples of that as well. So we're going to be great shepherds of the taxpayer dollar. We're going to stop doing things that we don't need to do anymore. We're going to push the pause button on other things so that we create an opportunity to go and spend the money that is available on the priorities of the state, especially during a global pandemic. We're going to be very, very aggressive about getting federal funds in as well. We're not going to be shy at all about going to Washington, D.C., getting the Indiana congressional delegation, our senators advocating for us with the various agencies of government to get Indiana additional funds to do the things that we need to do. And after all of that is exhausted, then we'll look at revenue sources and can we be more efficient in bringing the revenue in? And then if we do need to make decisions about additional revenue, what's the low-hanging fruit? And I've got an eye out right today for one opportunity there. That's Indiana's cigarette tax is far lower than it should be. It's far lower than some other states around us. That's a target that I think is ripe for us to utilize. And it has the twin benefit of when you raise the price of a pack of cigarettes, fewer teenagers smoke. Unambiguous, clear-cut evidence of that. Wouldn't it be a good thing if fewer teenagers smoked in Indiana? Right now, about 21.8% of adults smoke, and smoking is one of the components of so many diseases like heart disease and certainly lung disease. It's related to infant mortality as well. So if there's any revenue enhancement opportunity, that would be the one that I would target.
Before I want to talk about education, obviously. Before I get to that, I want to ask about one of the things that's grabbed headlines very recently, which is obviously the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Her death, and so the vacancy that has opened up on the court, is seen as having huge implications for the future of reproductive rights in this country. Mm-hmm. As that conversation relates to Indiana, we've seen several years now legislation filed in the General Assembly to ban all abortions, period, mm-hmm. across the board in Indiana. That legislation hasn't gone anywhere, in large part because Republican leaders have said, well, the court is never going to uphold that. We're not going to just pass a bill to get into a legal fight. That's for another day. Well, that reasoning it doesn't hold quite so much, especially as we look at a new conservative balance on the court. So I'll ask very directly, if a total abortion ban came to your desk as governor, would you sign it?
Well, there are a lot of steps, as you outlined, to get to that. We don't even know if the president is going to for sure appoint someone, likely will be this year, week, but we don't know that for a fact. We don't know that the Senate is going to take it up. We don't know that is going to pass. We don't know a lot of things. And then we don't know what a court will rule and how it will rule. And then we don't know how that ruling will affect Indiana. So that's a lot of ifs. Is it possible? Sure, it's possible. But there's a long way between here and there. And in your hypothetical question, I think it's very important for the women of our state to have the conversation, the very difficult, challenging conversation about that issue with their doctors. If they want to involve their clergy, that's great as well. I would encourage that. But it's a decision that I think that the state of Indiana should stay out of. We now know that it's probably the most difficult decision that a woman will ever make, but it is her decision. If the Indiana General Assembly doesn't find that other things to do instead of spending its time on that issue, then I don't think they're paying attention as well as they should to the jobs that they've been elected to do. I'm very worried about us intruding in the relationship a woman has with her doctor, and that's not something that I would support.
Well, Dr. Myers, thanks so much for sitting down with me.
Thank you for asking. Good to be here.
Hey, this is Matt Pelzer. You've been listening to an extended interview with Democratic candidate Woody Myers, who's running for Indiana governor, conducted by Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Now a conversation with the Libertarian candidate for governor, Donald Rainwater. These interviews were shortened for time, but what you'll hear is unedited.
Well, thank you so much for sitting down with me. I want to start by asking about the thing that's dominated the headlines and seemingly a lot of our lives the last 6 months, which is, of course, COVID-19, this global pandemic. As a libertarian, what do you see as the role of government in addressing the pandemic?
Well, and as you answer that or ask that question and use the word addressing, I think that government's role is to provide the citizens with the information necessary to decide for ourselves how best to safeguard our lives and the lives of our families. I believe that all too often the idea that government can protect everyone is misguided, because we're all unique, we all have unique situations and challenges in our lives, and the idea that government can make a broad-based set of decisions that then works for everybody. I think over the last 6 months, we've seen very clearly that that doesn't work.
What about the government? Governor Holcomb's response hasn't worked in your mind? Because we did see a lot of cases and deaths early on, and then there's been more testing, and the number of cases as it relates to the number of tests has come down in recent months. So it seems he touts those numbers, says it's clear the response is working. What about it didn't work for you?
Well, first of all, scientifically, we can't say that the government's response is working, because there's no scientific baseline that exists to show what would have happened had no one done anything. So to say, well, what we've done clearly worked, is deceptive, because we don't know what would have happened had we done nothing. Secondly, I believe that it is imperative that we understand that in many cases and in the lives of many, many, almost a million Hoosiers have had to file unemployment claims since the first week of March. We have no idea what the economic ripple impact of the executive orders will be from now over the next couple of years. We don't know what the health impact will be to people who had issues that were not allowed or not able to get them addressed. Medical issues that were not COVID-19 during the lockdown period. There are people who suffer from mental illness, addiction, other situations such as domestic abuse, that during the lockdown period, we have not seen any assessment as to how that transpired, what people who were affected by these things during the lockdown, what was the result of that? And so we don't know whether the cure was actually more damaging than the disease or not. And to say, well, obviously what we're doing is working, when here again we have no baseline, and we haven't really been given all of the data on all of the collateral damage, if you will, done by the decisions made by government, it's hard for me to just sit back and say, yeah, everything's great.
Much has been made about the governor's mask order, and I don't call it a mandate. It isn't a mandate.
He calls it a mandate.
He does, and I've never quite understood that, because there's no enforcement. He's repeatedly said that he's not enforcing it. It's education.
For interrupting.
No, that's fine.
But I feel, again, that's an area where government is trying to deceive the citizens, because originally he wanted to create a criminal penalty. He was advised that that was not legal under the Constitution, so he pulled that back, but he continues to use the word mandate, knowing that the majority of citizens will take the word mandate and say, oh, if I don't do this, I'm going to get in trouble, so I have to do it. And that is a way that government can enforce its will even when it shouldn't be.
We know science tells us that wearing a mask works in terms of limiting the spread. Nothing will stop the spread entirely.
Absolutely.
But it does significantly limit it. All the studies tell us that's the case. So is there then a role for government to do whatever it can short of actual enforcement? Is there a role for government to say, we need to do everything we can to get people to wear masks?
I believe that there's a role for government to give people the information they need to make well-informed decisions. You cannot make someone else do what you think they ought to do. I tell people consistently, I believe that God gave us free will. Whether you believe in a deity or you believe in natural law, natural rights, however you want to frame it, we were created with free will. I don't believe government's role is to take that away from us.
This is Matt Pelser. You're listening to an extended interview with Libertarian candidate Donald Rainwater, who's running for Indiana governor, conducted by Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. After a quick break, we'll be back with the rest of the conversation. If you want to hear Brandon's interviews with incumbent Governor Eric Holcomb and Democratic candidate Woody Myers, you can find them on our website or as a podcast. Just search for All in Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're listening to extended, unedited interviews with the two men challenging Eric Holcomb in the race for Indiana governor, conducted by Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Now we continue the conversation with Libertarian candidate Donald Rainwater.
So let's say you were in the governor's chair 6 months ago as COVID-19 reached Indiana and the United States. What specific actions would you have taken to try and get this state through this pandemic?
Well, I think first and foremost, information and education. Again, one of the things that I think is extremely important is to understand the nature of a crisis before you react to it. I was taught that there is reaction or response. You react when you're unprepared. You respond when you are prepared. I believe that the majority of what has gone on has been reactionary. I find that when you tell me we're going to do this for 2 weeks and then we're going to reassess, that's a reaction. We're going to throw this on the wall, hope that it sticks. In my estimation, we should have been more focused on where do we find the baseline? How do we know what it is that we need to do? And I think one of the things that clearly indicates that we were really reactionary is that we were told right away that one of the things we needed to do was protect the most vulnerable. Yet the majority of people who have tragically died from this virus in the state of Indiana are over the age of 60. Dr. Box said that herself. And that over half of the people who have passed away in nursing homes or long-term care facilities. So the very people we said we were going to be protecting were the ones that were the most affected, which means that the actions we took didn't really effectively protect those whom we said we were going to protect. So I feel like here again, because there were a lot of knee-jerk reactions to we need to lock everything down, make everybody stay home, we protected the people who needed the least protection and didn't really focus where we needed to.
The other thing I want to ask about as it relates to COVID is the money that's come from the federal government, primarily by way of the CARES Act, intended for COVID relief. Indiana is still sitting on $1.3 billion of that 2.4 billion we've gotten.
And many of the folks who are still unemployed haven't got unemployment checks,
right,
because our unemployment insurance system is antiquated. The Department of Workforce Development says they're understaffed. We were wholly unprepared to put that many people out of work, yet we're not helping those who were displaced economically by the governor's unilateral executive orders.
So
and I find that disturbing.
So then how would you prioritize the spending of that money?
Well, I believe that people who lost their jobs and people who, and this is here again, the terrible ripple effect of this, and apparently either the lack of understanding of what was going to happen, or God forbid, the fact that they didn't care, that people wouldn't be able to pay their rent, which means a landlord isn't going to get the revenue needed to turn around and pay his bills, which is in effect then going to cause other people to not be able to get the revenue they need to keep their business going. And so small business owners in particular, and I'm talking about the mom and pop, the sole proprietor, the partnerships, the LLCs that are the foundation of Indiana's economy. These folks need help. The businesses who have said, because I was shut down and mandated that I couldn't operate, I can no longer stay in business. You know, the PPP was great for a short-term fix for some businesses. But we've far gone past the short-term fix. And so I believe that individuals and small businesses need help first, because they were the ones who were impacted first and probably impacted the most.
So the other thing that's captured a lot of headlines this summer that I want to talk to you about is the role of racial injustice and police reform in our society. If you were the governor of Indiana, we've seen Governor Holcomb unveil some actions he wants to take within his administration with an eye towards potential reforms through the legislature when they reconvene in 2021. We know what Dr. Myers has proposed that goes a lot further than what Governor Holcomb has proposed. But I want to ask you, if you're governor of Indiana, as you see the problem of racial injustice, not in, just in government but in society in general, what then is the role for government to help address that crisis?
Well, I think, first of all, and it just so happens that earlier today, a very intelligent man whom I was having a conversation with made a very, very insightful comment to me. And he said, as a black man, and he's an African American, he says, as a black man, I recognize that we can't go back and fix hundreds of years. You can't do that. You can't erase what has happened in America. And he said, the first thing we need to do is learn to forgive. Now, I believe that much of the what we'll call racial injustice has been government overreach, the unnecessary interference of government in the lives of people that, here again, whether it was to oppress someone or to attempt to make up for past bad acts. And it doesn't work. You can't use government to fix something that really can't be fixed. You can't say we're going to make up for what has been 400 years of bad action. All you can really do is say, what are we going to do today to make sure that moving forward, everyone, no matter of race, gender, sexual orientation, or any other discriminatory category, is treated just like everybody else. And I think that's an extremely important thing that we need to do. We need to come together and all understand that we're all human beings, we're all Americans, we're all Hoosiers, and that we have to work together collaboratively to come together and recognize what is in our history and who has been wronged and how they've been wronged, and then agree to move forward together. Anything else is only going to compound the problem.
As part of this discussion that's been going on for the last few months, we've heard, well, certainly the notion of defund the police, which some take to mean getting rid of all funding for police. What it seems by many proponents to mean is reprioritizing those dollars, saying, why are we spending so much on a police force when we could also be spending it on social services and mental health services, and not necessarily sending the police to every single 911 call that you get? And then there's also the question of police reform in general, which is looking at use of force and tactics and things like that. So aside from the defund the police or reprioritize police funding, what role do you see for that and for police reform? Is there, as governor, where would you stand on those issues?
Well, I think the first thing that we need to say is that in every occupation, there are good people and there are bad people. And the bad people need to be removed from the profession. And we need to have an honest, straightforward discussion about holding individuals accountable for individuals' actions. And I don't think we do that today. I think we all too often want to blame a group of people for one person's bad actions. And we need to hold individuals accountable when they do something that is either illegal or just wrong. And so I think part of that is I'm a proponent for body cams. I think it protects both the officer and the citizen. I believe that we need to do better training with our police force to teach policemen how to handle a situation in the least forceful means necessary. And a lot of people talk about, well, we should be sending social workers or counselors or out with the police on calls. I wouldn't want to do that just because I don't want to put someone who has been trained in therapy and counseling in harm's way. I think that's kind of irresponsible. Now, if that means that we train police officers to be able to handle more types of situations in a much more broad-based manner, I think that's what we need to do. We don't benefit anybody from putting people who aren't trained to handle a dangerous situation in a dangerous situation.
Before I move on to education, I want to ask about one more thing that has been in the headlines very, very recently. Of course, the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And with her death has come a sense that the future of reproductive rights and abortion rights in this country could change in the near future with a new balance on the court. and says that relates to Indiana and the governor specifically. We've seen in Indiana in the legislature the last several years bills filed to ban all abortions. And the line out of Republican leadership in the General Assembly has been, well, we're not going to consider that because the current Supreme Court will never consider it. That might not be true anymore. So as it relates to you running for governor, let me ask you this. If you're the governor of Indiana and a bill comes to your desk that bans all abortions in Indiana, do you sign it?
I would say probably. I would also say that based on what I have heard, that probably won't be the case. Because here again, I think it has been made very clear that most of the judges who are currently being considered for the open spot on the court agree that they don't believe that Roe versus Wade will be overturned. And so while I understand the very polarizing nature, I also believe that until something of that nature actually is resolved and a bill gets through the legislature, that it is very unlikely that a governor of the state of Indiana will see a bill like that anytime in the near future.
Okay. So education is always a big deal in an Indiana governor's race. It's more than half of the state budget, but it takes on a little extra significance for the first time this year because, of course, the governor will now appoint the state superintendent of public instruction for the first time.
Yes.
As well, instead of that position being elected. So as it relates to who, as governor, if you're hiring that state superintendent, what qualifications are you looking for?
Well, I'm looking for someone, first of all, who has not only been involved in public education, but someone who also has experience and knowledge and open-mindedness toward educational choice in Indiana. Now, one of the things that I hear people say is, well, you know, if you support charter schools and private schools and online schools and any other innovation in education, you're taking away from public education, and there are students who that is their only means of education. And I challenge that thought because one of the things that I've seen over the years is that I believe we unfortunately politicize education entirely too much in the state of Indiana. Our children are our most important natural resource in Indiana. Our children really are our future. And for us to say that we are going to use education as a political football personally offends me. And I think we must do a much better job of providing quality education in the classroom, and we need to focus on making sure that the dollars that Hoosier taxpayers pay for education get to the kids in the classrooms. And I don't think that happens today. I think we spend way too much money on things that don't directly educate our children.
Mr. Rainwater, thanks so much for sitting down with me.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to an extended interview with Libertarian gubernatorial candidate Donald Rainwater, conducted by Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Tomorrow, we have a show on this year's Heartland Film Festival, which is happening virtually and kicks off this week. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. In the meantime, I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.